QST or CQ or on websites, and they give you very interesting ideas of what to do. There is no limit to what we can do with this great hobby.
I think Dick used to say there are 29 different types of ham radio, and I think that list was an undercount, W2TDD.
KD2RMD.
Yes, Russell.
I've known about the excitement of FD8, especially on 6 meters and 10 meters, and there is a lot of activity about it. That's a good way to see if 6 or 10 meters is open, too. On 6 meters, 50.313, if you hear FD8 activity, it's a good indication that the band is open. And same thing with 10 meters. I think 10 is 28.074. Yeah, if you hear FD8, it's a good indication that it's that tent is open. You can also look at the citizen's band as a beacon to see if the band is open. But I don't do anything on the digital side of the hobby. My radio isn't even interfaced with a computer. It's, you know, the magic to me is hearing someone's voice come through the speaker. It just puts goosebumps on my skin. And there's a lot of people on 40 meters. Almost every night, I sit on 7196 or 7197, and I call CQ. Because there's not a lot of people calling CQ, I like to call CQ. And I get a steady stream of people answering me on a nightly basis right at dinner time. I can work 10 to 15 stations in an hour with casual use, so it's no problem. And with the with the special event that started getting underway, Kilo 2 Hotel, I was working on pileups on 40 meters. So, you know, the activity there is just a matter of getting on the air and same thing. Over.
Good point, W2TTT. I'm going to stand by.
Okay, Gordon. Yeah, Russell. 40 is great. 80 is good, too. I mean, you're not going to get much out of 80 at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. But you let the sun go down, and 80 is pounding away. So 40 and 80 are great. 20 is kind of iffy. You can catch good hours where it's semi-decent. And then some people like 17. It's kind of thin. 15's even thinner. And when you get up to 6 meters, lots of luck. But, yeah, it takes all kinds. And sometimes people do a little bit of everything, but I could certainly understand. FD8 is great if you want to play tag, if you want to wallpaper your wall with QSL and worked or whatever. Some people like that. Some people don't. They've tried to redesign and repurpose some of the algorithms for FD8 into something that they have to call JS call because their previous name was a little too close to FD8. And that allows you to insert some text so that you can have a little bit of a personality with the contact as opposed to just the facts.
Question.
Yes, Wesley.
Isn't the data rate is so slow? It's only 5 WPM.
Yes, Wesley. Unfortunately, you cannot trick the laws of physics. If you want to be able to transmit signals that are recognizable even below the noise floor, you have to give something up, and the thing that you give up is the symbol rate. So the transmission of data is excruciatingly slow. And that's why they keep it to just the facts, because in applications like JS Call, in which you can type a long-winded sentence, that single sentence can take as long as 3 minutes because the software will parse it into three separate transmissions during a 30-second cycle each minute. So yeah, it's excruciatingly slow. But that's the price you pay. The benefit, though, is that you can communicate with places or power that you could never talk to because you'd be below the noise floor.
So probably that's why special combination of tone and time delays are inserted at the start and midpoint end of each transmission because Otherwise, that would look the track of keel lacking on it.
Yeah, there's a lot of built-in error correction. There's redundancies, there's error correction. I'm blocking on Joe's last name. He's a Nobel Prize winner, and he's one of the guys who worked on these low-strength signals. And they're wonderful to take a look at. I mean, the algorithms and what the heck went into the engineering of the thing. But it's sort of, I appreciate their ability more than just playing tag, because I was never a big fan of playing tag. So I enjoy the technology, but I don't particularly use FT8. I don't need a worked all states certificate. So, yeah, again, different strokes for different folks.
Joe Taylor, Edway 28.
The last question that I have is how you are able to synchronize the computer to UTC within 1 second for the parties involved in the conversation.
Well, it's relatively easy these days. There are places called time servers. Universities, Columbia has a time server, the NIST has a time server. The entire internet is covered by time servers that are calibrated with actual atomic clock accuracy. And I think Microsoft even has it built into its system that every so often it'll communicate with a time server and correct for any variation. You could also run other software applications and choose a list of preferred network time standard servers, and that's the least of the problems these days. You're going to get a very accurate time clock.
Did you try that mode?
Yes, I did. Because again, I was sort of fascinated by it in totality. I found it again kind of empty. I didn't enjoy the experience. You could probably simulate this all with some software. Matter of fact, there was one time that I swear I did not have an antenna connected to the thing, and it was spitting out data. So I'm not sure if it was just it was able to pull it out without an antenna, or whether it was so prone to generate data that it didn't need any real data to work on. So I didn't enjoy the experience personally, but again, I know people who love to do it, and the beauty with them seemed to be that they could do at least one other thing simultaneously, sometimes two other things simultaneously. It's almost on autopilot, which again, doesn't really work for me. The high point of my day is doing what I'm doing right now, is interacting with other people and getting new ideas from them that I hadn't thought of, or information and other such. And that's completely lacking in something like FT8. It's just the facts, ma'am, just the facts.
I'm wondering whether you're using Mac or you're using Windows platform, because from my experience, the Windows facility synchronization usually not adequate, and there is a recommended program for it, which will be a network time protocol setup. I believe it's called Mainberg NTP that is suggested to be installed for that mode. And to issue.
Well, yeah, there are a few software applications that serve that same purpose instead of the, I don't know what it is, once a day and hard-coded time servers. It gives you a menu selection, and you can synchronize your clock every 10 seconds if you're crazy enough to want to do that. The recommendations when I first installed it was to install those applications and run it, which I did. I use Windows. I use my Microsoft Windows. I was never into Apple, and I was grudgingly into Windows. By I went from a Atari 800 to an Amiga. I loved my Amigas. They were the first truly multitasking computers, a 1000, and I think it was a 3000. And the company went out of business, and I had to figure out where I was going to go on the fork in the road. One end was Apple, the other end was PCs. And I decided that you get more variable options and applications going by Microsoft and PC than Apple. And so I turned right or left, what have you. And I've been a Windows user for more than 20 years, I guess, by now.
Thank you very much, Roy, for the chance talking to you about it. Interesting.
W2TTT.
Yes, Gordon.
So I sometimes get into the same conversation. If you want to tinker and you want a reasonable set of options in the mobile environment, you know, Android's your boy. If you want a level of plug and play, and I would say about the same level of stability as the as the mainline, you know, Android community, then you can buy yourself an iPhone and an iPad, you know, a Mac and all that good stuff. You know, they seem to be a little more user friendly, but at the price of locking you down to things. So I mean, I think both have their advantages. It depends on what kind of user you are. I myself like the Android environment. I like Ubuntu Linux, and I use Raspbian on my Raspberry Pis. So those are the three operating systems I spend the most time with. And because I can tinker with them, but I also can get stuff off the shelf that's plug and play. So it's a fair mix.
AC2GS. I agree with you entirely, Gordon. Android is somewhat more for people who like to get under the hood and adjust the valves and change the timing a little bit here and there. As far as computers, I tend to put both Apple OS X and Windows in sort of the same category of they kind of lock you down. You can adjust a couple of things around the edges. But as you mentioned, if you are a true tinkerer and you want to get things the way you want to get them, Linux is sort of what people use. I remember when the only way that you could get things done in Linux was to be a command line guru. And remember all the little flags that you had to set for whatever cryptic command you wanted to do. It's gotten less so with graphic interface, and it's become much more amenable to non-computer guys, but it's still a little intimidating to many people. Sometimes people want to not worry about setting the controls and such. So I totally agree with you on that.
Yeah, and I didn't mention Windows, but, you know, I use Windows daily, both personally and for work, and it's fine. But, you know, I've just gotten to the point where, you know, it's not necessarily going to be my favorite way of moving things around, and but there's an awful lot of stuff for it that you can just download. I think Windows has a lot more of a variable library than you know OS X does, or even the iPhone or the iPad. But neither here nor there, they're still, you know, if you're looking for absolute stability with no problems, I don't think they offer some good options, and I think Windows is almost as good in that regard. And I would say Android is almost as good in that regard. But, you know, again, if you don't want to tinker, you don't have to with those environments, and that's what's nice about them. There's enough stable stuff for you to mess with, and enough knobs and dials and levers available if you so desire. Anyway, what do you call it? I just wanted to ask a question because I've been absent for a couple of weeks other than last week, I guess, a little bit. Is the format of the TechNet the same as it has been?
For the most part, it's a kind of a three-part thing, although since I do the first and the second part, and there were questions, and we don't get that many technical questions the last few weeks, I kind of stretched out the technical portion for the first 2 hours, and soon I'll be handing it over to Paul. But for all intents and purposes, we've pretty much kept it to the same type of a mode. The first hour, the idea is the technical questions. The second is general scientific discussion. And the third is the Paul Space Report.
Okay. And just for reference, the Barra TechNet, which is Thursday nights on 835, 146-835, is patterned on the core part that Dick started and that you complement. We don't have a space portion and things like that, so I just want to tip my hat to both of you, you know, just say that having Dick gone is, the first time I ever heard of Dick was looking at his picture in or on QST in front of a large antenna array that was in a ham magazine that was stuffed inside probably in English or social studies or probably English English or social studies text in junior high school or high school. So that's how far back I go. It's 50 years plus ago. So I'm just, my mind is boggling here. W2TGT.
Thank you, Gordon. The E-Log, the Limark newsletter, asked me to write up a eulogy for Dick. And one of the pictures that I included was a picture of him standing on his antenna array, proud as a peacock. And underneath I said, by the way, every so often Dick would say that he was afraid of heights. And that picture kind of didn't look like a guy afraid of heights. So, I saw some of those pictures, too.
Yeah, actually, I saw your clip, and it was very well done. Complete with that picture of the 16 element, or 16 bay KTRAW Yagi array. And it's kind of funny, I have a couple of KTRAWs that I keep in the basement for portable operation, and they don't get beat up too badly, and boy, but this is tough stuff to watch him pass. Anyway, kudos to you and Paul and the rest of the gang for keeping it going, and my heartfelt condolences to everybody who knew Dick better than I did, but boy, he was a great influence and an inspiration. He and Wayne Overbeck, oddly enough, K6YNB, now N6NB, were my heartfelt inspiration early on. There are a couple others too, JK2OVS, and there's a couple others, K1WHS, a few others like that. Anyway. I'll say 73 for now because I can only get in when I'm driving, unfortunately. Unless I'm up in the shack and I can't get there tonight. I've got so much going on. But 73 and thank you. W2TTT.
Well, thank you, Gordon, for your kind words. I mean, the measure of a man is the impact, I think, that he made on other people. And by that measure, echoes of Dick will bounce down the ages because, you know, we all do the things that we do because we watched him do his stuff and we learned from him. I still run another technical net on another repeater, and I kind of base that on his first third portion of the technical net. So he will be remembered, and not only that, but people will echo him for many years to come. So thank you, Gordon, for your kind words.
73 right, W2 TTT clear and in the driveway.
Okie doke. I once again want to remind people we really didn't get into the science talk portion, but you know, we'll do it next week. I just want to remind people, if you have any questions that you can't get onto the technical net, or topics you would like to hear discussed, or if you have any questions or topics for the science talk, or want to refute something that I said, as long as you give me references, don't just repeat that an opposite comment and without any references. But or if you want to give me a puzzler, or if you want me to pass on something to Paul and have him check up on a story or a website or such, the email address is mailbag@ac2gs.com. Again, mailbag@ac2gs.com. And links to some things that I put up, even though I didn't really get to them, but they'll be available. They're interesting and on their own. You can read them later on after poll is done. And you get there by typing in roy.ac2gs.com to the URL of your browser. So once again, I want to thank everyone who participated tonight and made this TechNet as interesting as you all did. Please come back, because we'll do it all again next Sunday night. And now let me summon forth Paul, WS2N, for the space report.
AC2GS, WS2N, very good, Roy. And it was great to hear all these technical topics. I'm kind of missing that lately. With the coronavirus, that's kind of taken over a lot of the topics. And hopefully that's on its way out. I think it's not going to go fast enough for me. And it slowed a lot of things down in the space-related project around the world. You know, I mean, it's affected. We have countless launch facilities around the world. That some of them have pretty much come to a halt, like one in New Zealand. That's a rocket lab that launches electron rockets, and that, you know, they worked out to a grinding halt. There's a lot of other military satellites and things that still have to go up that are considered essential. So there's a few of those topics that we can discuss. And of course the International Space Station, with presently 3 people on board, and in most cases, there's always a couple of them that are hams that are able to usually work the schools, you know, when they're up there. But I don't think that's going on. You're not going to put too many students in one room to talk to the astronauts like we used to. Let me drop it. But anyway, there's a flight that, again, is considered essential. It's called the X-37B. And that will be launched this May, you know, May 16th, by an Atlas V rocket from Launch Complex 41 in Florida. And the X-37B is a small space plane. It has to kind of look as like a space shuttle. And it's been around a long time. It goes up on a rocket and it does its mission. It doesn't go to the space station. It's military. And it does its act for, in the beginning, it used to be months on end. And now the last flight lasted for 2 years. So the X-37B will be going up again this year. Last time it just came back in October. Stayed up for 2 years. They have 2 of these vehicles, so they switch on and off. Started flying in 2010, actually right before the end of the shuttle mission. So, you know, you had the final mission by Atlantis in 2011, and the X-37B took off and landed in
that time in California and landed on their runway and that was Air Force Base. Each time they've gone up since that time, they've spent more and more time on the base. You know, it's got cargo doors similar to what the space shuttle had. Opens up, solar panel comes out. They've tested ion engines on it, and we're really not sure what they do because it is a military top secret mission. We know when it goes up and we know when it comes down. And of course, it's unmanned. And they have the Atlas V, which launches it. And one time they also launched it on a SpaceX Falcon 9. And what they do is they encapsulate the whole thing inside the fairing. And then when the fairing pops open, it's a roughly 30-foot vehicle with, you know, maybe a 15-foot wing comes out of it and stays up there a couple of years and eventually comes down. Well, that will be going up this May. And I'll be looking forward to seeing that. And seeing the launch anyway. You probably get it on YouTube. But usually after it goes up, they cut it off. They don't even want you to visually track where it's going. Although there's a lot of astronomers or people with telescopes that track these things. And they eventually figure out what altitude it went to and what inclination it's on. That's for the X-37B. No plan of making it for a crew. Although there is one in development that has nothing to do with this. This thing was built by Boeing. A company called Sierra Nevada Corporation is building a Dream Chaser, which is about the same size as this thing, maybe a little bit bigger. And that will carry cargo to the International Space Station. And someday in the future after that, they will eventually put a crew in there. Actually, it was designed originally to have a crew, and then NASA just wanted another cargo vehicle, so these people stepped up and said, okay, we'll make a cargo vehicle. And hopefully that will get off the ground probably the end of next year, maybe the beginning of the year after that. And that's a space plane as well, that will be put into an Atlas V rocket. It has wings that fold up. After that launch, the Dream Chaser will open its wings up, dock with the space station, and eventually come back. And that will carry more weight than any of the other ones. More cargo, more payload. The Progress cargo vehicle that goes up on a regular basis, maybe 5,000 pounds. You have SpaceX sends up the Dragon crew vehicle with maybe 6,500-7,000 pounds at the moment. Then you have the Cygnus cargo vehicle that's now sent up by Northrop Grumman from Virginia, Wallops Island, Virginia, and that brings up even more weight, closer to 8,000 pounds. And once this vehicle gets going, you'll be able to do over 12,000 pounds, probably a little bit more than what the HB2 by Japan sets up. We have all these different cargo vehicles that go up on a regular basis to supply the space station. With that, is there any comments or questions that people had even before I started talking? This is WS. Okay, there was another flight right soon after that. X-37B goes up. There's another one that's going to be launched by SpaceX. And it's going to be a crew flight, which is going to be big news. talked about this last week and the week before, but I'll talk about it one more time. You have astronauts Bob Behnken and Doug Hurley. They were all ready to go. They're in isolation, so they don't get the coronavirus. And hopefully they launch on May 27th to the International Space Station on a Falcon 9 rocket from Launch Complex 39A. Of course, in Florida, that's the famous launch complex that the shuttles, a lot of the shuttles, over half the shuttles launched from, and including the Apollo Saturn V rocket, launched from 39A. So it's been reconfigured for SpaceX to launch the Falcon 9 rockets, as well as the Falcon 9 Heavies. Falcon 9 Heavies are the ones where you take three Falcon 9 rockets and you kind of bolt them together and set them up in one piece using two of his boosters, two of his Falcon 9 boosters as, you know, secondary boosters to the main core. And that vehicle has launched three times so far. But this one is going to be launched on a single Falcon 9 rocket. And it should be pretty exciting. We know that's going to make the news. So, first time since 2011 when Atlantis went up in that summer. And originally they were going to stay like a week, 5 days, come back, but now they've got permission to stay for actually a couple of months. So you have a crew of three, and they really like to have more than that up there on this space station. You know, the space station's big. And it needs a lot of maintenance. And three people, I mean, they can handle it, but they're getting very, very little science done. One American and two Russians right now. Chris Cassidy is the American. So at least you'll have two more Americans joining them to help out. You know, if you look at that space station, it's maybe 150 feet long in a bunch of modules all lined up, and to maintain that, maintain the truss section, you know, which is about the length of a football field, with all those solar panels, batteries, takes a lot of maintenance. Many EVAs, hundreds of EVAs have been done over the years, mainly for maintenance. Looks good. It'll dock with the IDA, the International Docking Adapter, which was installed a couple of years ago by, again, an EVA astronaut that did some data hookups and power hookups to this adapter, especially designed for all future crew missions that will dock with the space station. In fact, they have two of them up there now, so you have two possible ports to have a crew, and you have two other ports that you have for cargo for the space station, and that's on the American side. On the Russian side, you have four more ports that, you know, that are occupied by Soyuz spacecraft and Soyuz Progress vehicles. And I hope that goes off. I can't imagine what Florida is going to do. I know they opened up their state to, you know, someone. Like I mentioned last week, I can't imagine what they're going to do. You know, people are going to want to see this thing go. And sometimes it was time to attract millions of people, you know, go to different locations down there. And then I could be able to do that, keeping 6 feet apart. So I hope they really stress for people to watch this thing on TV. This is WS2N. Any questions or comments? Okay, with that, there's a vehicle that's also not being affected by the coronavirus, and that's called Perseverance. Perseverance is the new name of the Mars rover that will be going to Mars on the July, I believe it's July 17th, something like that. And, you know, I'll talk about it more when we get to it, but, you know, toward the end of July. And that's you know, it's a six-wheel rover. Looks like Curiosity, the one that's up there now, nuclear-powered, you know, with an RTG, a radioisotope thermoelectric generator, puts out around 100, a little over 100 watts, and it's on all the time, it's on at nighttime. It also charges batteries, gives them a little extra power if it needs it. So, you know, no solar powers panels required. The only solar panel on this whole flight will be on the helicopter. The helicopter is mounted to the belly of the Perseverance. And when the rover finally lands on Mars, it'll go through EDL, entry, descent, and landing. Direct shot. It doesn't go into orbit around the planet and then come down and land. It's a direct shot. You know, once it leaves Earth, it'll do a 6 to 7 month cruise, and it'll go right through the atmosphere, 13,000 miles an hour with the heat shield. And you can see that Mars atmosphere is very rarefied. It still gets hot as heck. You know, probably 3,000-4,000 degrees as it's coming through the atmosphere. And that will slow it down to some degree. And eventually you have supersonic parachute that will come out. Something like 85, 90 feet diameter. And that will slow down eventually like 300 miles an hour. And get lowered to the ground. And when it gets about 5 miles or so off the ground, that parachute will be disconnected. It'll just be in what they call an aeroshell. The back aeroshell will disconnect. The heat shield will disconnect. The back aeroshell will be holding the Mars rover and the sky crane. And as it comes further down, that back shell will lower the rover on cables, about 50 feet below the thing, and the jetpack will fire with eight rockets, eight pulsing rockets, and that'll bring it down all the way, you know, it's like a mile, and eventually slow it down to almost zero, and the wheels will unfold from Perseverance and land on the ground, and they'll have these pyrotechnic devices fire, which have like little blades on it, which will cut all the necessary cables from the sky crane. Sky crane will fly away about a mile or so away from where it landed, and the rover will be on the ground. Below the rover is the helicopter, so he's sitting on the belly of this thing. And you know, after everything checks out, they know everything's good. The helicopter will be put onto the ground by Perseverance. And it's got these big, long, 4 foot blades that will come out. And on top of that is this solar panel. That's the one solar panel on the whole setup. And hopefully that thing flies. And they finally came up with a name for the helicopter. It's now going to be called Ingenuity. Ingenuity was named by Vanessa Rupansi. She comes out of Alabama, and she wrote an essay, high school student. People submitted essays, and eventually they picked a winner. She's the winner. So she's got the name Ingenuity for the helicopter. So that should be interesting. Naturally, it's an electric-powered helicopter. And massive blades, you know, they're opposing blades. One goes one way, the other one goes counterclockwise. And the body of it is like a box. And it's four legs coming out of it. So hopefully it'll be able to take off, fly for a minute or two, and then land. And again, do it again. They hope they can get at least five flights out of the Ingenuity. And knowing that, if it's in good shape, they'll just keep using it until they can. So that's the story on Ingenuity and Perseverance. And it'll launch, like I said, in July, and we'll land in Jezero Crater in the beginning of next year, February. So that's what they always do. They always name these things. They always have students name them. And that goes way back. Even like with the one that landed in 1997. That's one.
Funded yet,
preliminary funding is, you know, has started the design, but they plan on creating a MAV, a Mars or a SET vehicle. So you'll be able to send a vehicle all the way to Mars, have another little rover go out, pick up all these samples that Perseverance will be creating, these little core samples, pick them up, bring them back to the Martian ascent vehicle, put it on the MAV, and shoot it off into orbit. Have it linked up with a, let's call it a mothercraft, an orbiting spacecraft, and have engines on that, and have it fire to bring the samples back to Earth. I remember when Sojourner was being designed and Pathfinder. By the way, Pathfinder is, you know, was a lander, and they had these big pedals open up, and the rover came out from Pathfinder. So it was actually two vehicles in one. You had the lander and you had the rover. But when they were designing that, people in Jet Propulsion Laboratory was really wondering. They thought, you know, we're really going to have a Martian return mission very soon. They were even thinking maybe as early as 2001. Now you got to remember this thing landed in 1997 on 4th of July, and they thought, well, maybe we'll even have a Martian return sample mission by 2001. Here we are, decades later, really, and talking about a possible sample return mission. Any questions or comments? This is WS2N. Okay, we have another Starlink mission going up to crowd up the skies up there. Right now it's 420 satellites for the broadband internet that SpaceX has put up there, and it's going to launch 60 more, which is going to bring them up to 480. So that'll be going up actually this week, May 7th. So, it's not always something to watch. The booster goes out, comes back on, and lands on a drone ship vertically, back and lands. It's got these four legs that come out. And even the fairings that open up on the front that release these 60 satellites, they try to save the fairings. They'll be coming down, and they're going to try to catch them on these boats as well, and two boats floating around in the Atlantic Ocean to do that. And last time they caught a half, but the other half they didn't catch, but eventually they fished it out to sea. And they reuse these things. Each one is $6 million, and why throw it away? We've been throwing away stuff, bearings, since the beginning of the space program, and no more, which I think is a good thing. Okay, there was another successful test by SpaceX, talking about SpaceX. It was the Starship. They called the SN4. So there was an SN1 and 2 and a 3. Well, all three have been tested with liquid nitrogen, and they've all kind of failed. I mean, literally completely failed. For different reasons, but they got better at it on each one that they put together. These things stand 220 feet tall. It's actually the second stage of what will be a monstrous booster. The whole rocket, the whole Starship will eventually be taller than, or as tall as the Saturn V rocket. But the second stage is what they're working on first, and their goal is to eventually launch it actually into orbit without a first stage. I mean, that's how powerful it's going to be. Liquid methane, liquid oxygen, and Elon Musk has been working on this for some time. It's going to be powered by these Raptor rockets. So they just ran it through another test last week, and this time it was successful. It held together without the tanks crumbling or welds leaking, and or the these gigantic ramps that are on the bottom that are duplicating the force of three Raptor engines. Each Raptor engine would deliver 400,000 pounds of thrust. But hey, yeah, got these big ramps, hydraulic ramps pushing the bottom of the vehicle when they run these tests. And one of those ramps actually helped to create a problem on one of the previous tests. But this vehicle, SM4, survived. They blow it around five bars pressure, one bar is atmospheric pressure, 14.7. And so this thing survived almost 73 pounds of pressure. I think he was looking to get higher than that on the previous one. And, you know, just to see what it could take, I think he went up to 127 PSI. This got up to around 73. And I guess they called it. Feels that's all you need to try to make this thing fly. And I think within a week or two, he's going to be ready to test fire these Raptor engines to see if he can get this thing off the ground a little bit. This is WS2, and eventually they plan on launching this thing just a little bit, and then they want to get it up to around 500 meters. And then eventually up to 5,000 meters. You know, they're looking to get it up to like 12 miles high. It will be the ultimate goal, and then be able to bring it back. That works. They're going to put three more engines in it, so we're going to have six engines. And they think they could launch it eventually to orbit. So hopefully that eventually works out for them, because this is his goal. Is he plans on not building dozens of these rockets, but literally thousands of them over the years. And he plans on using them to colonize Mars. So, meanwhile, I think NASA's going to, you know, borrow one to see if they can bring them to the moon, help them get to the moon. So, NASA's having a little problem trying to complete their vehicle, the SLS, Space Launch System, with the Orion spacecraft. I think four, five, 6 years behind schedule, I think. Let's see, I think the original goal was to get up to 2017, so maybe 2022. And the year that they are predicting that they'll probably be eventually able to put a crew on this thing, 2022. That's not good. I think our Starship might be the bump to not only Mars but Moon as well. We shall see. One other comment topic I wanted to cover was the spaceship two out in New Mexico. You have a spaceport, and spaceport is called Spaceport America. And New Mexico had this thing built, you know, getting completed maybe 10, 15 years ago. But very few small rocket companies have launched anything from it. And, you know, mostly suborbital test flights. But it's now the home of Virgin Galactic. They built the Spaceship Two that Richard Branson has developed. Now, it's flown many times in California, Mojave, but that was just test flights. He wants to be able to do this on a regular basis from New Mexico. And this vehicle will take paying passengers up to suborbital flights, you know, above that Kármán line, 100 miles up, and see if they can bring them back safely and land on a runway here. So this is the first time that White Knight 2 is a carrier aircraft, jet engines, and put this vehicle underneath, and it carries it up to, you know, where an airplane would fly, you know, 45,000 feet, and, 8-9 miles high, and then drop it to test, and eventually, this is the first time they did that out in, with Spaceport America, and it came back and successfully landed on the runway. So that's another step in the right direction. And eventually White Knight will eventually take this vehicle up to the same height, and eventually they'll fight off a rocket, or they'll drop it, and then the rocket will launch, and the crew will go up to suborbital space. They were hoping to bring Payne customers on board, but you know, for this year, I don't think they're going to make it. Still have more tests to do, and now they have coronavirus fighting. But they do plan on trying to get Richard Branson. He's the one that's developed this thing, the lead behind it. He wants to eventually fly on it as the first person, first person to do it. Actually, it'll be probably the second. They've already had a crew and one engineer do it out in California. They went up to above the Common Line. So, actually, we've had people launch from American soil to space already. But, you know, what people want to see is people go into orbit, we'll go up to the space station. And that's what SpaceX will be doing very shortly, at the end of this month. Any questions, comments? If not, I'm going to turn it back to Roy. We'll be back next week. This is AC2GS. Back to AC2GS. This is WS2N. Back to you, Roy.
Okay, thank you very much, Paul. This is AC2GS Roy here. And we're coming up to 10:57. I want to remind you of a few things, as always. By the way, any particular closing questions need answering? Anyone has anything that they wanted to ask before we shut it down?
KD2NBB.
Yes, Bob.
Yes, Roy. In regards to Dick, I just want to make a suggestion. I know this would be a lot of work, but I remember 3 years ago when John Beck, I don't know his call sign. I never knew him because he exited just before I got into ham radio. But I listened to that entire, the wake you guys did. And you set up, Roy. That was like several hours. I listened to the whole thing on installments. Anyway, it would be great if something like that was done for Dick. I know it's a lot of work. I think you were the guy who did it. But I'm just throwing that out there. That would just be great if anyone wanted to ever do that. So that's my comment, and back to you, Roy.
Okay, thanks, Bob. Yeah, John was KC2WGB, and I asked if someone was interested in a radio wake, and they said, excellent idea, why don't you do it? And so I did it. We sort of had a mini one last Sunday night. If people out there are interested in something like that, to remind people what we did for John was about a month or so after he passed away, because he kind of went off and died quietly without a fuss, which was John's way. I thought it would be nice to have some kind of an opportunity to say goodbye to him on the radio. And we had his lovely daughter Donna sit in with Wesley on because she doesn't have an amateur radio license. And we went from something like 10 o'clock at night to about 5 o'clock in the morning. I kind of leave it up to the audience to decide whether they would be interested in something like that, because, you know, you need people to participate with you. You can't do that by yourself. So if anyone is interested in something like that for Dick in a few weeks, please let me know by email. Let me kind of gauge the interest. If people kind of want to participate in that, I would be happy to run something like that.